Krishna. We will continue reading from the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Chapter 16, how Parikshit received the age of Kali. We are going to read text 2 today. Please kindly repeat responsibly. Sa utarasya talayam.
Upayena
iravatim. Jana me jaya dims chaturas.
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 So try again to get it right. Janame jaya dims chaturas.
Janame jaya dims chaturas.
Tasyam utpadayat sukham.
Tasyam utpadayat
sukham. Sautarasya tanayam.
Sautarasya tanayam.
Upayama iravatim.
Upayama iravatim.
Janame jaya dims chaturas.
Janame jaya dims chaturas.
Tasyam utpadayat sutam.
Tasyam utpadayat sutam.
Sa utarasya tanayam.
Sa utarasya tanayam.
Upayama iravatim.
Upayama iravatim.
Janame jaya dims chaturas.
Janame jaya dims chaturas.
Tasyam utpadayat sutam.
Tasyam utpadayat sutam.
Sahi utarasya.
Utarasya.
Of King Uttara.
King Uttara.
Tanayam.
Tanayam.
Daughter.
Daughter.
Upayeme.
Upayeme.
Merit. Iravati.
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 Janame
jaya din.
Janame jaya din.
Headed by Maharaj Janame jaya. Chatura.
Chatura.
Four. Tasyam.
Tasyam.
In her.
In her.
Utpadayat.
Utpadayat.
Begot.
Begot.
Sutan.
Sutan.
Sons. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, His Confounder Acharya A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. King Parikshit married the daughter of King Uttara and begot four sons headed by Maharaj Janamejaya. Purport. Maharaj Uttara was the son of Virat and maternal uncle of Maharaj Parikshit. Iravati, being the daughter of Maharaj Uttara, was the cousin sister of Maharaj Parikshit. But cousin brothers and sisters were allowed to get married if they did not belong to the same gotra or family. In the Vedic system of marriage, the importance of the gotra or family was stressed. Arjuna also married Subhadra. Although she was his maternal cousin sister, Janamejaya is one of the Rajarishi kings and the famous son of Maharaj Parikshit. His mother's name was Iravati, or according to some Madhuravati. Maharaj Janamejaya begot two sons of the name Gyatanika and Shankukarna. He celebrated several sacrifices in the Kurukshetra pilgrimage site, and he had three younger brothers named Shrutasen, Ugrasen, and Bhimasen II. He invaded Takshala, Ajanta, and he decided to avenge the unlawful curse upon his great father. Maharaj Parikshit, great father, Maharaj Parikshit. He performed a great sacrifice called Sarpa Yagya to kill the race of serpents, including the Takshaka, which had bitten his father to death. On request from many influential demigods and sages, he had to change his decision to kill the race of snakes. But despite stopping the sacrifice, he satisfied everyone concerned in the sacrifice by rewarding them properly. In the ceremony, Mahamuni Vyasadeva also was present, and he personally narrated the history of the Battle of Kurukshetra before the king. Later, on the order of Vyasadeva, his disciple Vaishampayana narrated before the king the subject matter of Mahabharata. He was much affected by his great father's untimely death and was very anxious to see him again. And he expressed his desire before the great sage Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva also fulfilled his desire. His father was present before him, and he worshipped both his father and Vyasadeva with great respect and pomp. Being fully satisfied, he most munificently gave charities to the brahmanas present at the sacrifice. Om Agnati Mirandasya Agnardana Shalakaya Chakshuran Militam Enatasmei Shri Gurve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manavishtam Sthapitam Ena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kamayam Padati Swaha Padantikam Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinabandhu Jagatpati Gopisha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Vevacha Atitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Chimasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare So we continue with the story of Shukadev Goswami and Parikshit Maharaj, and here we actually hear how Parikshit Maharaj is actually left very powerful king. His name was Janmejaya, who was acting as a king after the departure of Parikshit Maharaj. So after Parikshit Maharaj was cursed by a Brahmin boy to die in 7 days, he went to the Ganges to seek spiritual guidance, to take shelter of some authority who could actually help him attain perfection. So then he met Shukadev Goswami, and within these 7 days which were left according to the curse, he actually heard the Bhagavatam. And because of that we have today the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. So Parikshit's curse is our blessing, because in that way the Bhagavatam was recorded. Parikshit Maharaj was a devotee. It's not that at the last moment he decided to become a devotee. He was a devotee throughout his whole life, and when this unfortunate incident happened, he decided to take shelter of the sages at the banks of the Ganges, because throughout his whole life he was trained to take shelter of the sages. So his immediate response to crisis was to take shelter of the sages. So how many of us would do that if there is a crisis? How many of us would take shelter of devotees, how many of us will take shelter of our own minds? So all of that will be determined by how much we have absorbed the essence and the science of bhakti throughout our life. Because in this world, crisis is certain to happen. And every practice that we have is meant to prepare us for these crises so that we can handle them. The final crisis is the time of death. So, now we're going to take shelter of Krishna, or we're going to take shelter of our mind. So therefore this practice that we have is very important. It's significant because it has an impact on the outcome of our life. It's not just some kind of a social club for sense gratification. Without any higher purpose, like the nihilists, they think that life has no purpose. And everything is just to have fun for the moment. So someone may think that devotees, they also gather together to have fun for the moment. And that this is why we are practicing. Not really. We are practicing to prepare ourselves for facing the crisis that will come. And ultimately the final, topmost crisis, leaving this body. And depending on how we apply ourselves to the process, we'll get results. Some of us may apply 50% or something, 30%, then you'll get that kind of result. So it's very, very specific. It's not that all of us in this room here will get the same result if we apply ourselves differently. If we apply ourselves with the same intensity, we'll get the same result. But if we don't, then we'll get different result. We are not cheaters like the Christians say, just have faith and you all get the same destination. We are understanding from this process that it depends on the level of one's consciousness. So it doesn't mean that you become part of a social club or religious club that you'll get the same benefits because you're a member hanging out, hanging in, around. This brings the question of really understanding our teachings and taking full advantage of the teachings of Srila Prabhupada, Shukadeva Goswami's teachings to Parikshit Maharaj. Now, from this verse, what we can learn is that the Kshatriyas, they followed the culture that was established by their predecessors. For example, Janmijaya Maharaj, he got married. He didn't get a girlfriend, you know. So he was following the culture. And we can learn from this that this is teaching us something different than what the Western civilization is teaching today. Like the Western world, there is hardly any talk of marriage these days. Very few people decide to marry and then they get divorced very quickly, within few years. Very few marriages survive the pressures of modern civilization. So the sociologists are thinking, you know, we have a problem. Because if you have marriage, it's good for the economy, because people in a family will consume more. There is kids, whatever. But if someone is a single, then they'll consume much less. So marriage is good, but because they don't want to get married, we don't know how to get them into marriage so that we can have better economy. So the sociologists don't know what to do. How life has turned around in such a way that people are not interested in committing to marriage anymore. So nowadays they just wave their hands up in the air and they say, ah, just let them do what they want, you know. It's all right. It's okay. We just have to accept the evolution. Society is evolving. That's what they think. Probably we're evolving into something else. So we are breaking away from the old chains of primitive thinking, marriage and all that. That's what they think. So, but is it really evolving or devolving? We can actually see that it doesn't lead to any happiness to be alone. You know, living alone in this world or having multiple partners. Even if you examine the basic level of happiness, how much happiness one experiences by being a single person, or how much happiness one experiences in a family, well-organized family, cultured family, then even on that material level, the family people, they have much more happiness because the children make them happy and so many events and social things are happening there, there is so much more happiness in family than being single. Single, you're just miserable, lonely, waking up every morning, you know, thinking who you're going to call to hook up with today, and it's just a miserable life of loneliness. There is a phenomenon today, it's called the phenomenon of loners, and it's becoming very big. In Sweden, apparently 46% of the teenagers live alone, which is now the next step of the direction that they are taking. You know, some years ago, I guess from the 60s it started, people used to live together without marriage. Nowadays they don't even live together. The girlfriend has her own flat and the boyfriend has his own flat. They live separate. And basically they prefer like that because they think, you know, I don't have to commit to someone else and be controlled. And because if you live with another person, then your freedom is limited. You know, you have to consider the feelings of the other person, their likes and dislikes. So in that way, your freedom is limited because everyone is into too much freedom these days. Freedom from the oppression of relationship. So they think that relationships are causing limitation, and ultimately they become encumbrance to their happiness. They think, I'm happier if I'm alone, you know, nobody will just bother me and so on and so forth. So in that way, the phenomenon of loners is spreading all over the world. Also people feel, I'm free, you know, I can hook up with any other girl, any other man this evening and tomorrow with next person, and still I have a girlfriend, but it's okay, you know. You know, after all, you know, I have to do what I feel is good for me and what makes me happy, and you know. So they think this is real life, to be free, to do what you want, to have a free society, democratic free society where you can just do what you want to be happy. So this is definitely happening, and it's increasing in the US, Japan and Europe, other different places, like gradually growing. I don't know in Australia how this phenomenon is manifesting, but definitely it's growing because people don't know how to relate to each other anymore. So they just want to use each other for a short period of time in the day, and then they just want to have their own space to do what they want. So this is actually the evolution of modern advanced intellectual society, where you're going to have children with one parent. Most of the time it's the mother. And the children will not know even sometimes who is their father. And this is very advanced, very intelligent society. Very progressive. And the basis of all that is the worldview that they have. What is their worldview? I am just a bunch of chemicals. I appeared accidentally, and basically I have no higher purpose than just trying to feel happy here and now. And this is the goal of my whole existence, try to find happiness somehow or other. Whatever will look like it's going to produce happiness, then I'll do that. So this is actually due to worldview, and that worldview is definitely connected with atheism, because theism means rules and regulations. Why? Because someone is sick. Theism means that you're taught that you have an illness, that you have a problem if you have this mortal body. And to recover that problem, you have to follow some rules and regulations. But atheism means these rules and regulations are, and, you know, becoming an encumbrance to my happiness. Therefore, you know, throw God out the window. In any ways, we don't see Him anywhere. Maybe He doesn't exist. We want to see Him before we believe or before we follow His rules and regulations. Just throw Him out the window, throw all His rules and regulations out the window, and just do what is right, what you feel is going to bring you that happiness. So, this is modern civilization. And then we see that if you examine the statistics, that there is so much unhappiness. Even you don't have to examine statistics, you just go on the street and look at them. Look at the people, how they live. They are constantly, you know, chasing after some pleasures. And ultimately all the pleasures in this world have consequences. For example, drinking alcohol, it dulls you, it makes you miserable, it gets you sick, and if you become an addict, you develop different diseases, cirrhosis and so on and so on, and then you die from that. So some people may not drink too much, they may drink little bit like that, just to dull the pain that they're experiencing. You know, because every one of us is born in this world, so we know that living in this world means that you experience pain. So if you're experiencing pain, then you have to find some outlet to diminish it or to remove it. So they find the outlet of removing the pain through drinking, for example, or having illicit affairs, temporary hookups, or you know, entertainment, going to movies or things like that, just to tantalize the mind a little bit, to kind of excite it for a while, to forget the real problems that they have. So they are not really dealing with the pain they're experiencing. That pain, according to some Sufi text, is called the sacred wound. We're all wounded, we're bleeding, we're all suffering in this material world. There is something missing. And you know, atheistic civilization is preaching that you can fill that gap through hedonism. Just do what you feel is right, explore the pleasures of this world, and then you will fill that gap, certainly, you know. But make sure you work very hard to make more money, because if you get more money, you will feel that big abyss in the heart. And the more money you have, the more you feel it, the more it will become filled in. So that is the idea. So how are you going to make the money? That's up to you, by hook or by crook. If you don't get caught, it's all right, you know. And this is actually what's going on. So how people make money today is through consumerism. Business means selling many, many things simply to turn money or just get money, things that we don't need actually. And this is encouraged. The more you have money, the more you consume. But now there is a problem with that, that this kind of consumerism has many side effects. It destroys the environment, it destroys the health, destroys the psychology of an individual. And then you get basically a whole bunch of psychologically imbalanced people. They can't cope with reality. They can't even relate to one another. So they may say, this is not a psychological imbalance, this is according to your worldview. So, but, you know, they can say this is our worldview, and their worldview is that you should live alone, so on and so forth, you know. So you can see how people may develop very defective or deformed type of perspective about what is right and what is wrong. And they say there is, you know, there is nothing right. Everything is, you know, okay. You just do what you feel. But at the same time, they themselves justify that what I'm doing is right. You know, what I am doing is right. But they are saying what you're doing is wrong. But at the same time, they say there is no right and wrong. You know, like that. So, in that way, we could understand how this kind of thinking is definitely damaging society in very, very big ways, because you get, like I said, social disturbance. You have no strong families where there is mother and father. People don't even know probably sometimes that the family must be with mother and father these days. They think it's only just the mother, that's how it is, you know. Some kids in Africa, that's what they think, you know. So it's tremendous dysfunctionalism that goes on in the world. If you just compare it to what you see in the Shastra, it's completely crazy. So now how do we know Shastra is right and they are wrong? Maybe they are right and we're wrong. You know. So why should we believe like just, you know, maybe this is right, you know? So this is actually very, very important. Prabhupada wanted us to understand this philosophy so that we could remain focused in our practice so that we can attain the goal and also teach that philosophy appropriately so that people can understand, and especially from the youth. If they are not trained up from small, then there is a big problem. And if sometimes if they are trained up from small but they are not trained properly, then there is problems which will manifest later on. And one of the things is, if you examine our kids in ISKCON, you see more than 50% they don't become devotees. They just give up. That means we are not doing something right. We are doing something wrong. We don't know how to present the philosophy to them. We don't know how to organize ourselves so that these kids will feel comfortable. They'll see the future in our society, and they will just remain. This is not only our society. In any society, Catholics, Muslims, Jews, they have this problem because this atheistic philosophy is becoming the most dominant. And why it is? Because it is in the schools and it is taught as a fact. And all your kids are going to schools and they're learning all that stuff. And then you're teaching them here on Sunday program or something, or Bhakti Vriksha, something different. They think my father and my mother, they're crazy, you know. They're not scientific. We can see the books are explaining how we evolved from the monkey and how this happened and how that. So if one is a sentimental devotee, then he or she will not be able to handle the whole situation. In fact, even the very fact that we send our children to this kind of schools is sentimentalism. I'm saying something very, very strong. It's sentimentalism that you allow them to go and study in these schools, because this is a slaughterhouse for the intellect. You know. So basically, how do you expect your son or daughter to become a devotee if you send him to a slaughterhouse for the intellect? You know. So it is really a challenge that ISKCON has to address. And wherever we have schools, in that place the children are becoming devotees. And they stay in the movement and they feel happy and satisfied and protected. And also they understand the philosophy. It's not just like sentimentally they're just hanging in because their parents are devotees and they were put through school. But they really understand the philosophy and they become very strong proponents of the philosophy. They teach it. Like, for example, Bhaktirtha Maharaj, when he was a child, he was a child evangelist. They made him a preacher. They trained him up how to preach. They looked after him. They explained to him how to present the Bible. And he would mesmerize big audiences. Small child. Imagine a small child sitting on the Vyasasan and explaining the philosophy powerfully. Yeah? How attractive is that? How amazing is that? So we see only some senior people, but it's very attractive also to have the youth preaching. So we have to cultivate that within our community, because this will definitely strengthen us all over ISKCON. So how do we know whether Bhagavatam is right or wrong, whether marriage is right? Maharaj Janamejaya got married and now we are not marrying, and maybe Hare Krishna is an obsolete, bygone era conscious people and like backwards, and they're just holding back to the past of their ancestors. How do we know? Well, we know if we're really sincere, if we study Prabhupada's books very carefully, we will get all the answers. Because Prabhupada is very logical, is very scientific. Prabhupada never speaks like, I think it's like this, I think it's like that. Prabhupada represents parampara. Parampara represents the creator of this world. The supreme creator, Krishna. And where can we learn in the best way about what is this world all about and what we are all about and who we are and what are we supposed to do than from the creator himself? From the original supreme conscious entity that is organized this world. We can never get any better information about the world. Just like if you want to know something about this machine here that is recording the class, you have to go to the people that created it. So the scientists that are coming up with these atheistic theories, they didn't create the world. How on earth would they know what's actually going on? They have no idea. They're just speculating. So now someone may say, but you didn't see Krishna, you're also speculating. But Prabhupada said that even if a neophyte devotee, he repeats what the Creator is given, or what the Supreme Authority is given, even if he doesn't fully understand, he is perfect in a sense of what he's speaking. His speech is perfect because he's representing the teachings that come from this ultimate authority. So, if you repeat what an authority is saying, then that is perfect, even if you don't understand it fully yet. But if you speculate and you come up with other concoctions, it will always be imperfect. And these things can be measured. Again, the results can be measured. And what are the results? Like I said, in our society, people are becoming more unhappy. And they're becoming more into drugs and alcohol and very short-term relationships. Working longer hours and, you know, being pressed by economic demands, and they're becoming more and more miserable and more happy. Even the devotees who work outside, although we have the theology, because these pressures are there, if you don't fully absorb your consciousness into Krishna, then you will also suffer. Just like the materialists, so less, much less than them, but you will also experience that. So, really what helps us to distinguish between the quality and quantity of happiness one experiences is if one is actually absorbed in the philosophy by knowing it and living it, immediately he or she will feel much more peaceful, no matter what kind of crises we're going through, what kind of challenges we're going through. But if you look at the materialists, they can't cope with things the way devotees can cope. Devotees can be much more resistant to pressure and so on and so forth, because they understand their identity, they understand the world, they know how to cope with difficulties, because there is this connection with also the super soul, also the instructions of the spiritual master. So they are more balanced as in individuals and as families and communities, if they really follow properly. But if you don't follow properly, you actually get bashed. So sometimes you may think this philosophy doesn't work, you know. I'm chanting, I'm reading, but I'm so miserable, you know. That means we're not really understanding fully the science. And that can be a big problem, because if we remain on that superficial level of just repeating without understanding like a parrot, there will be a time where we may be so much challenged that we may even leave ISKCON. There is so many instances like that. Or if not leave, we may just become stuck on some level of devotion and just maintain that without increasing, without progressing, without expanding our consciousness and connection with Krishna, which is the real goal of why we do what we do. So we get kind of different, lower, lesser goals becoming prominent, and then we get stuck on that level. So we have to understand very deeply that you know, these teachings, they're multidimensional, and that it depends how you apply yourself, that's what you're going to get out of it again and again. And that means we have to become very, very serious in deeply studying and applying the teachings more and more. We may be doing very well now, but all of us know there are areas in my life where I'm weak. There are things that I don't understand. There are things that I can improve upon. And then I have to work on these areas rather than just sweeping them under the carpet. The main area that we need to work on is to improve on our chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. To have discipline to really apply our intellect to study Prabhupada's books and be able to explain them and apply them. Because if we don't apply them, we won't get the result. Just gain some knowledge in the head. And another thing is that every application requires sacrifice. You cannot apply something without sacrificing. And this is where a lot of devotees fail. Because we don't want to sacrifice. We feel comfortable where we are. Sacrifice means to push yourself beyond your limit. Now, like, for example, to make it local, you know, you're planning to have a school, you know, in the near future here in Melbourne, right? So that requires sacrifice. It's not going to fall from the sky. So if the devotees don't come up very seriously pursuing this, understanding the problem that is there, that if we don't have this school, then our kids will be taken to the slaughterhouse of intellect, intellectual slaughterhouse, and we are gambling whether they'll become devotees or not. Because most of the influence, they spend most of their time with people that teach other stuff and do other stuff. And they spend 1 or 2 hours with you in the evening. So it's very, very dangerous. So what I'm trying to say is that applying means, understanding means applying, and applying means sacrifice. And sacrifice means that there must be this a deep understanding before we actually enter into the realm of sacrifice. Understanding Desha Kala Patra, understanding the teachings, how we can apply them, and what our role is in the bigger community in order for that goal to be achieved. Collective or individual goal. So, Prabhupada explained very clearly that the worldview leads to a specific type of thinking, the thinking leads to behavior, behavior leads to specific results, and then you are responsible. It's a science, it's like that. It's a worldview, thinking, behavior, result, responsibility. It's five things. So if you think in that way, if you have a this worldview, you'll think like that, and there is a specific responsibility. And Srila Prabhupada explained that the basic thing is we have to get a proper thorough education of the scriptures, that we understand what is the difference between matter and spirit, and understand the implications of just thinking in terms of matter or just thinking in terms of spirit, and the behavior that comes along with it. So Prabhupada was very much focused on smashing scientific theories and atheism, because he saw the problem. He wanted schools where children can be exposed to devotional service. Then of course the devotees in early days failed him. Nowadays we are doing pretty good when there is schools, but in the early days devotees were young, immature, so there was a lot of failure. But that doesn't mean that we should back away from what Prabhupada wanted to be manifested in this world, you know, in terms of social structure. So, Prabhupada knew the importance of proper education, understanding, application, proper role models, because in that way he was seeing the success of his society. And if we don't do that, then there will be either mediocre success, which will just benefit very few people, small amount of people, or even less, very few individuals may get the benefit of being part of this movement. But Prabhupada wanted this movement to become a movement for social transformation on the basis of spiritual transformation, and to become a movement that could actually lead society to God consciousness. This is the purpose of our movement. So each one of us holds a responsibility, and we are accountable to Prabhupada. What we're doing with our time, how we're acting, how we're planning, how we applying ourselves at each and every moment, and what is the outcome, what is the impact. We have to measure also our endeavor, what we are putting into doing something, and what's the outcome. We have to always measure to be able to see whether we're going on the right track or not, so then we can adjust, redirect ourselves constantly. So these are very serious things and very deep things, but I speak about them because it's a real challenge. We're surrounded by a sea of atheism, and we're like a little dot, like the dot on the moon of theism in this world. And our children are getting affected. Sometimes the teenagers get affected, sometimes even older people get affected, because they are submerged, surrounded by this atheistic bombardment that is going on in the world. Now, to finish with a few more points, we can actually read this book and even teach this book to the devotees, because this book, if you read it very carefully, it completely dismantles the so-called evidence that the atheists are speaking about in relation to Darwinism and evolution and so on and so forth. It is very, very thoroughly written, very carefully presented, and very logically. And I think this is an extension of Life Comes From Life, Prabhupada. I'm saying something very strong here. This book is written by Lalita Nath Prabhu from Denmark. And this book, I think, is an extension of Life Comes From Life. How many of you have read Life Comes From Life? You know, if you haven't read it, then just buy it and read it. Otherwise, if some atheist attacks you, you won't be able to answer. You'll just kind of tell them, just get lost or something like that. Don't disturb me. Like one person was telling me, he's got problems with his son. He's not becoming a devotee. So he told me, you know, he told me that the son is dissecting and analyzing everything from an atheist point of view, and he's trying to smash the philosophy of Krishna consciousness through the books he's reading. So the father's answer was, you know, if the child is happy, dancing, you know, experiencing some happiness, why do we want to dissect where the happiness is coming from? By dissecting, you'll kill the child and then it's all finished. So in other words, don't try to analyze, don't try to understand. It's like a blind following, you know. What kind of education is that, you know? So this is very, very shocking almost, that devotees don't know how to explain to their kids what we're all about, and they put them through atheistic schools and they're expecting that the children will become devotees. That is like very a slim chance that they'll become a devotee. I've seen it in South Africa, I see it other places. Very slim chance. So we have to think very carefully what we're doing. In South Africa we have teachers, like for example in Cape Town there are a few teachers and so on and so forth. So I've been telling them for some time, let's think how we can open a day school. It doesn't have to be a boarding school or whatever. But somehow or other, we're just held back by Maya. And the kids are going to other schools, they develop other ideas. They think my father and my mother, what they believe, it's something different, and what is the reality, something different. So in that way, we're losing, you know, that battle is getting lost. We may be bringing new people. We've got so many students in South Africa that come to our programs, teenage students that come, but we're losing our own kids born in ISKCON. That's a big problem. So we have to think very carefully where is the pink prick. And again, I think I'm saying it is we need to actually think very seriously and do this sacrifice at establishing schools where the children can be accommodated, catered for, and this will give them much more chance of an opportunity rather to absorb the bhakti Siddhanta, the philosophy, and in that way to remain focused in devotional service. So yes, please try to find this book and read it very carefully. Read Life Comes From Life by Srila Prabhupada. We can devise, you know, also seminars and talks on these books that could explain things in detail. I didn't go into the detail. I wanted to share some, but I kind of got stuck on the social implication of following this way or that way. But there is a tremendous evidence that, and logic and evidence that points towards theism, and that points towards you know, the fact that we are not just some kind of bunch of sentimentalists and bunch of cop-outs. We're just kind of weaklings. We just use the crutch of God, like the communists were saying in communist countries, that, you know, this religion is like a crutch. You know, some person can't explain the world, so he believes into something and that's his crutch to cope with world and the world and so on and so forth. No, it is actual real science. Prabhupada stressed it again and again. This Krishna consciousness is science. There are two types of science: to understand matter and to understand spirit. You understand matter by studying from devotee scientists like Lalita Nath Prabhu, for example, who has done a lot of research. There is another powerful disciple of Shivaram Maharaj, Ishvara Krishna Prabhu, who has written a book also called Nature's IQ, extremely powerful book. That book also you can read and try to understand. Now that is the one aspect. The other aspect of the science is to study the bhakti science very carefully. How to chant properly, how to read properly, how to perform service, whatever services you are performing, how to execute them properly, how to deal with Vaishnavas properly. So sometimes we only get into how to do this aspect and we just leave the other one out, and we kind of can't cope with people who are not understanding bhakti. We just can't relate to them, they can't relate to us, and we become like, you know, maybe few people who understand sentimentally and join us, but the others that are thinking a little bit, have a little brain, we just can't relate to them because we don't know what to tell them. They know all these bombardments from Richard Dawkins and all other speculators, and then we don't know how to defeat, how to argue with that, even if they are sincerely seeking, you know. So we need to have these two aspects of science. Bhakti is a science. And especially Prabhupada didn't want us to remain neophytes. He wanted us to become Madhya Madhikari, which means a preacher, one who goes out of his way to help others. If you don't read these books like that, you won't be able to relate to anybody in this world. Because that's what they know. And if you can't show them the defects of what they know, they will never take you seriously, especially in this modern society. Like some years ago, people are a little more kind of simple and they were not so heavily brainwashed or brain damaged by the system. But today, it's a big, big problem. I was watching one documentary a few days ago. Richard Dawkins is preaching like fire on internet. And these millions of people see that. And he was saying, you know, I think that because we are not teaching so nicely at the school, because we also have religious teachers who teach science, that's why our children are not becoming atheists. He was saying that. And he said he took a group of four kids and he took them to the beach and he was showing them, and he was trying to show them how everything can be seen through the eyes of evolution, or Darwin's perspective of unguided natural selection, etc. So there were four kids, or five, and then at the end he asked them, so what do you think now? Do you still believe in God or not? And four of them, they said, I still believe in God. The one said, I don't. I think you're quite right. So he said, I feel that this, even if those kids that say I believe in God, they're just sentimental. But if you explain to them a little better, if the teacher at school is not religious or Christian or something like that, then we'll indoctrinate them. This is going on the internet. So like that, we have to know the Deshakala and Patra. We can't just live in the 60s or in the 50s or 1934 or whatever. So we have to understand the reality now. We have to become very, very serious, very concerned about both aspects of the science. How to practice your bhakti properly, as well as how to present it to others according to Deshakala Patra. Otherwise, we become an obsolete, dysfunctional society that will decrease with time in terms of potency, in terms of membership, and, you know, in that way we can become the survival of the unfittest, the unsurvival of the unfittest. So we have to become focused. So of course we may say Mahaprabhu is in charge of this movement, and our failure is not going to stop this movement. But the fact is that, yes, he is in charge, but also you have the choice whether to become part of the victory or you have the choice to become part of the failure of specific individuals or groups of people that will ultimately be sucked in into materialistic society and pursuits and so on and so forth. So, here from the Bhagavatam we understand that Maharaj Janamejaya followed the culture, therefore he got married and he performed certain sacrifices and he took shelter of the sages they advised him not to kill the snakes, although he was angry and affected by the loss of his father. He took shelter of the sages because they were representing parampara. He had that humility. And of course he had deep knowledge. He wasn't just a blind fool who just thought, yeah, I'll just follow this because it's the culture, you know. Of course this is much better, to be sentimental and follow the culture, than being very intelligent fool that doesn't follow the culture. That is much better, to be sentimentalist who follows. But there is the danger that if one is sentimental and follows, there may be some challenge that you may not reconcile in time, and you may not follow after some time. So we have to go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, closer and closer and closer to Krishna, to be able to survive as an individual, as a community, as a society, and not only to survive but to impact on the external world, so that we could fulfill the prediction of Lord Chaitanya, assist Prabhupada to fulfill the prediction to make the golden age more and more present, and more dominant in our modern world. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki?
Yeah.
Any comments or questions?
Prabhu, you're talking about the Vedic school. Do you want that Vedic school to be a full-time or just part-time? Children can study in the ordinary school and also study in the
full-time
Vedic school. Full-time. So what's the future going to be of the children? Because when they grow up, they have to maintain themselves. So they can work and also trade.
Actually, if the school is accredited by the government, they can still get job, you know, in this society. But also devotees can develop, you know, their own industries and support one another, so they don't have to depend on the external society. So these are things that we need to do. So we don't have to always fall into the safety net of the external energy and whatever the external energy is offering. There are two devotee families in Bulgaria. They just saw, their kids were put into the ordinary schools. They saw what's going on to their kids. They just ran away from Bulgaria. They went to Mayapur and they put them in the school there. So they are there, the parents are there with their children, and they are studying in Mayapur. And the whole family is much more happy. Everyone and the children, they get involved in all the worship and celebration on a daily basis. And then they are learning at the school both secular sciences, like I was saying, as well as devotional science. And they have their peers, they have their friends, which is a very strong support system. If you don't have, like here, the kids, they live very, very far from one another, you know. And the kid may not have a friend to live next to him, so he has to associate with other people that are not following bhakti also. So we are in a very pioneering beginning stages of ISKCON. We don't have to remain always going in the same way, depending on other things, structures to do that. But also you can say that Bhaktivinoda Thakur was also working in the external society as a magistrate, you know. So why can't our children do? But how capable are our children to survive? This is the question. And I'm seeing more and more they're just getting lost. So then the problem is that we're not educating them properly so that they can survive. We're not looking after them so nicely so that they can survive. And even work in the external world and survive like their parents can do. You know. So it is pain that we have to go through, and we have to find solutions. And I think that full-time schools are the answer to that, because there will be friendship between the children, they'll have more association with one another. The whole day they'll be submerged in a devotional atmosphere. At night, at their home, devotional atmosphere. And in that way, they most probably, 90% they will remain devotees, if not 100. But otherwise, it's danger. You know, it's probably the smallest percentage may remain devotees due to this propaganda that is going on out there against theism. Yes, is that okay? Yeah.
You want to tell us something more, really, especially in Shubhya and Hernandez?
It was yesterday, I think. It was yesterday, but.
Today.
Is it today? Oh, maybe I'm looking the Cape Town calendar. I'm still on Cape Town Bawa. Okay. All right. Vishnu Priya, she was the second wife of Lord Chaitanya. At that time, Nimai Pandit. Mahaprabhu's first wife, Lakshmi Priya, left this world. The Acharyas explained she was bitten by the snake of separation. When Mahaprabhu went to perform the final rites of his father in Gaya, at that time she departed from his world. When he came back from that, she had departed from this world. So being still a young person and now having no father, Jagannath Mishra had departed as well. Mother Sachi requested Nimai Pandit to remarry because he felt that in that way he can be looked after properly, you know, by his wife, as well as Mother Sachi's needs as an elderly lady can be addressed. So that's what he did. He took his mother's advice and he married Vishnu Priya, who was a daughter of a very, very wonderful Brahmana devotee of the Lord. She was an incarnation of the internal energy of the Lord. And Vishnu Priya was very traditional chaste wife to Nimai Pandit, very supportive of him and of Mother Sachi, and of course they both loved her very dearly. So the greatness of Vishnu Priya is usually emphasized by after the departure of Nimai Pandit becoming sannyasi, Sri Chaitanya. He became sannyasi so that we can benefit, all of us. In other words, he showed the example of showing the topmost dharma, sanatana dharma, renouncing even the family for the benefit of everyone. So people cannot blame Mahaprabhu and say why he left his wife and all kind of nonsense like that, because actually what he did was an act of sacrifice for the benefit of everyone in this world, and we can see the effect is there. So we cannot blame Mahaprabhu in any way. And at least we can see the effect. Some foolish atheists may not understand, but the devotees, they understand. So then after Mahaprabhu taking sannyas, Vishnu Priya remained with Mother Sachi to look after her. She was extremely austere and very devoted to chanting Hare Krishna. So she would be so devoted that she would just chant certain number of rounds every day, big quantity of rounds, maybe as much as possible, probably not less than 64 a day. And she would just count one grain of rice for each round, and then after the end of the day she will take whatever amount of rounds she chanted for the day, she will take one that amount of grains you cook into rice, and then she'll take that. So extreme simplicity and austerity, extreme devotion. And she was blissful in ecstasy in that practice. It wasn't that she was the most miserable person on the planet, and you know, she was just suffering, her husband abandoned her. No, she was in ecstasy. She was absorbed in Krishna prema. She was not an ordinary mundane wife who was feeling abandoned and she's looking for another husband or something like that. She was completely focused on, first of all, serving Mother Sachi, and second, maintaining focus in her relationship with Krishna. Developing that relationship with Krishna, showing an example of perfect chastity, and both to Krishna and to her husband and to Sachi Devi. Then there are many actually celebrations today. Disappearance of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur also, who was one of the greatest acharyas in our movement. He wrote Guru Vastakam, which we sing for Mangal Arati every morning. He wrote numerous books on Vaishnava Siddhanta and commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, and he wrote many books that reveal some internal pastimes of the Lord on his Aprakat Lila and so on and so forth. He was disciple of Narottam Das Thakur, and he was extremely advanced devotee. He was married, but then he took sannyas as well. And Narottam Das Thakur asked him to, he wanted to test him because Vishwanath asked him for sannyas. Narottam told him, you go to your home tonight and you should sleep in the same bed with your wife, and then next day you should tell me what happened. So he went to his house and he slept in the same bed with his wife. He was in the same bed with his wife, but the whole night he was commenting on Srimad Bhagavatam, reading Bhagavatam to her. So the next day he told what his guru, what he did, and then he said, yes, you are fit to take sannyas. So he became sannyasi, and then he dedicated his life to spread the teachings of Krishna consciousness, write scriptures, and show an example of pure devotee. His disciple was Baladev Vidyabhushana, who wrote the commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Vishwanath was very old when they were challenged that they, by the Mayavadis, that you don't have a commentary. So his disciple Baladev Vidyabhushana wrote the commentary, and Prabhupada dedicated Bhagavad Gita to Baladev Vidyabhushana for very nicely writing the commentary of Vedanta Sutra. And then Raghunath Das Thakur, he was one of the great associates of the Lord, Lord Chaitanya. He was associating, and in fact through him we've got Chaitanya Charitamrita. He narrated Chaitanya Charitamrita to Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami, basically explaining different details about Mahaprabhu's pastimes in Puri, and that's how we get Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. So Raghunath Das was also a son of a very wealthy landlord, zamindar, businessman, and he was even a devotee, his father. But Raghunath was so attached to Lord Chaitanya and so detached from this world that he tried to escape from his family on a few occasions. Looks like all our acharyas are just escaping from families. If some karmas are listening, they'll say, you guys are just crazy or something. So we have to understand everything into context. So he tried to escape from his family. Even his family was devotees. So they tried to keep him behind, and they married him to a very, the most beautiful girl. She was like an apsara, but still no attraction. And the father was thinking, let us tie him with a chain. And the mother said, you got the best chain here, the most beautiful girl, and he's not chained up. What are you going to do with the chain? He'll just break it and run away. So they kept guards to guard him and so on and so forth. And at some point he actually managed to escape one night. And he met Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, and then that famous Panihati pastime, the cheap rice, which is served to the Vaishnavas. And he became an eternal associate of the Lord, Raghunath Das Goswami. Although Lord Chaitanya was telling him many times, don't run away, try to act as if you are attached, but think of me. But after some time, he just couldn't resist to associate with Mahaprabhu and to perform full-time devotional service. So Raghunath Das Goswami also wrote many books. He lived at Radhakund when he went to Vrindavan after the departure of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu from this world. To this day his samadhi is there, his bhajan kutir where he performed bhajan at Radhakund, and you can actually get his blessings. He's an extremely advanced devotee. He chanted most of the day. He took only a palmful of buttermilk every day to sustain his body. And of course, yeah, he wrote many books. And then Pundarik Vidyanidhi, also today is his appearance day. He, amazing day today. Pundarik Vidyanidhi, he was Vrishabhanu Maharaj, who incarnated as Pundarik Vidyanidhi to perform this lila with Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, or at that time the spreading of the Sankirtan movement by Mahaprabhu. So he was acting as a king, Pundarik Vidyanidhi, extremely wealthy person. He lived in a very costly, opulent lifestyle, and he was basically, if you look at him from an external perspective, he looked like some very posh materialist who would gel his hair and, you know, have the most delicious juices served to him by servants, and has most flashy clothes and lying on a bedstead with jewels and that kind of person. So when Gadadhar Pandit went with Mukunda Datta told him, let me take you to show you one very great devotee. So when Gadadhar Pandit went there in his palace, Vrishabhanu or Pundarik Vidyanidhi's palace, he was bewildered. He thought, maybe this man is just a materialist, you know. Mm-hmm. He was thinking like that because the way he looks. Then Mukunda Datta read his mind and he recited a verse from the Bhagavatam that was explaining how Putana was killed by Krishna and given a position of maid servant in Vrindavan. How merciful is Krishna that even the aggressors who try to kill him, they get a position as a maid servant in Vrindavan. So when Pundarik Vidyanidhi heard this verse, he was actually on a level of Bhava, devotion. Bhava means devotional ecstasy. He became insane and he started rolling on the ground, just thinking how merciful is Krishna that even the Putana demoness, he liberated her from the material world, and who tried to kill him, he liberated her and gave a position of maidservant. Just understanding that, meditating on that mercifulness of Krishna, someone who is trying to kill you, you give them a position of a maidservant. He became mad just by thinking of that. And he started rolling on the ground, crashing the objects, different furniture in the house, tearing his clothes, crying in ecstasy. And then Gadadhar Pandit thought, this is extraordinary. And he was not a crazy guy, you know. He was very balanced, normal person, you know. But just, he experienced that transcendental ecstasy by realizing Krishna's mercy, extreme mercy, even to the aggressors who tried to kill him, he's given them such a high position. So therefore he reacted in that way. Then Garadhar Pandit decided, I have to take Diksha from him, because otherwise I can never repay for the offense, or I never can restore the offense that I have committed to this great devotee. So he became his Diksha disciple. And who else is there? Raghunandan. Yeah, Raghunandan was a small boy who his father was Mukunda, or I think Mukunda. He was a Kaviraj. And maybe it's the same Mukunda, I'm not sure, the one that took Gadadhar Pandit to the house of Pundarik Vidyanidhi. But in essence, the pastime is like this, that this Raghunandan was a small boy and his father had to attend to some emergency, being a doctor, so he told him, you please kindly do the offering. When your mother cooks, you do the offering. He explained to him how, and he went on. And then when he came back, the mother was distressed and she said, you know, your son ate the boga. He went behind the altar, he put it there in front of the Lord, and then when we opened the curtain, the boga was not there. So I know this boy is a rascal, he ate the boga. So the boy was saying, no ma, I didn't eat. So she said, but how is that that the boga is gone? And she said, the boy said, I prayed to the Lord. I was standing there and ringing the bell and I could see he's not taking. So I kept praying, my dear Lord, please kindly take this, otherwise my father will chastise me when he comes back that you didn't take the boga. So he kept praying and praying and praying and praying, and then the Lord saw, wow, this boy will not give up, you know, let me just take it. He had so much devotion and rasa, sambandha with the Lord. So the Lord actually was forced by the devotion of that devotee, that little boy, to take it. So he ate it, and then the father said, come show me, you know, I don't believe in this. I don't think this happened. So they cooked again, and then he offered, and then the father hit, and the boy was praying like this, again and again and again. And then the father saw with his eyes that the prasadam disappeared from the plate. And then I think Lord Chaitanya was told that story, and he asked them in a joking way, who is the father? You. Which one of the two is the father? Who is more advanced? So this is Raghunandan. Did he become one of the associates of Lord Chaitanya later? I think so. I kind of missed this detail. But yeah, today then is a great day. It's a very auspicious day, and we can pray to all these personalities to develop our bhakti, to develop our consciousness, so that we can serve Prabhupada's mission better and better. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Anti Kori Vaishnava Vrinda ki jai. Gaura Premanande.